This is Central Time. I'm Rob Parrott. Coming up, animals perceive the world very differently than we humans do. A science writer digs into the wild world of animal senses, including some that we just don't have at all. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to take up a redistricting case out of North Carolina that election law experts say could lead to significant changes in how federal elections are run. The case could provide a ruling on a concept called the independent state legislature theory, which could give state lawmakers more unilateral power to set the rules for federal elections in their states. Republicans arguing the case say it would reflect a more accurate interpretation of the Constitution. Opponents say it could take checks and balances out of a vital part of elected government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you heard about this upcoming case? What questions do you have about it? Do you want state legislatures? Do you want Wisconsin's state legislature to have more direct power over the way elections for president and Congress and Senate are run? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Robert Yablon is an associate professor at the UW-Madison Law School. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Let's take this a step at a time. What is this case out of North Carolina that the Supreme Court says, yeah, we'll take a look at this later this year?
Well, the case is called Moore versus Harper, and it involves congressional redistricting in North Carolina. The legislature, the state legislature in North Carolina, is controlled by the Republicans. They drew new congressional districts after the 2020 census, and they did it in a way that tried to maximize the advantage of the Republican Party. And the map that they created likely would have handed Republicans 10 of the state's 14 congressional seats. Well, that was challenged. That map was challenged in North Carolina state court as a partisan gerrymander. And the North Carolina Supreme Court held that the map that the Republican legislature in North Carolina drew violated the state's constitution, threw it out. And ultimately, there was a new court-imposed map that was put in place, which was a more even-handed map. The legislature was unhappy about this, and they took the issue to the U.S. Supreme Court, arguing essentially that the state Supreme Court didn't have the power to step in and second guess their line drawing decisions.
And that takes us to this idea of the independent state legislature theory. People use it in a couple different ways, I think, but in a nutshell, what does it mean?
Yeah, well, you know, there are several versions of the theory and a range of different ways that it can be applied. But the basic claim is that the federal constitution empowers state legislatures to set the rules for federal elections unchecked by state constitutions or state courts or other state actors. In other words, that state legislatures are independent of the normal constraints on their authority.
So what would that mean if the U.S. Supreme Court said, yep, that's right, North Carolina lawmakers, you are the lone wolf on this one? What would that mean for election laws around the country?
Well, what it would mean for redistricting in particular is that the state legislature has the last word. And so if a legislature like the one in North Carolina decided that it wanted to engage in an aggressive partisan gerrymander, there would be no other state institution to stop it. And it could have wider implications than that. It could mean, for example, that those states that have shifted redistricting authority away from state legislatures and tried to give it to independent commissions, they could be thwarted because the court might say that the power has to stay with the legislature and can't be delegated to other actors. And then there are concerns that an endorsement of this theory by the U.S. Supreme Court could mean that other election rules, even beyond redistricting, could be held by the power to make those rules would be held by the state legislature alone, again, without constraints put upon them by state courts and state constitutions. And this has implications potentially for presidential elections. The independent state legislature theory underlied some of the efforts of President Trump and his allies in the 2020 election to try to encourage state legislatures to appoint their own slates of electors.
I've seen some critics of this idea who, you know, they don't like it in general, but they're not as worried about a post-election reversal of an outcome. The idea would be, okay, legislatures with this independent legislature theory could set up the circumstances under which votes are made and counted and tabulated and things like that, but they couldn't go back and alter the results afterward, which was what a lot of in the Trump camp were hoping to do to overturn the popular vote outcome in states. Do you worry that that line isn't as clear as some people are saying?
Right. Well, so, you know, the efforts in 2020 obviously didn't work out, but there are indications that, you know, there may be future efforts to try a similar scheme. Now, there are other federal laws that may limit the authority of the legislature after the fact to say, even though the voters voted for one candidate, we want to now step in and adopt a slate of electors in favor of the other candidate. But, you know, we would be in uncharted territory, and in the endorsement of the state independent state legislature theory would at least give a little bit of ammunition to those who would you know, attempt that, you know, that strategy.
Talking to Rob Yablon from UW-Madison Law School about a U.S. Supreme Court case, not one of this bundle of rulings they just issued, but one that they said they're going to take up later this year, saying that state legislatures should have more authority over federal elections, basically exclusive authority over federal elections for Congress, for president in their states. Forget the state Supreme Court or state constitutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that idea? What questions do you have for our guest? 800-642-1234 is the number to call or email ideas@WPR.org. Rob, I want to look at some of the legalese here behind this. The word legislature does feature prominently here in the, I think, in the constitutional setup for how these elections work, but it seems like pretty consistently people have read that to mean not just, like in Wisconsin, the Assembly and State Senate, but the legislative process, which would include a governor and the court system and the Constitution. Has that been read generally that second way more than that first way over history?
Historically, that has been the predominant reading for sure. Now, you know, so if you want to get to the constitutional text, you're exactly right. It does refer to the legislature. And it's really that one word that is the hook that the proponents of this theory rely on. Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution says that the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. And the proponents of this theory argue that that really means the institution of the legislature and maybe that institution alone. But historically, really, for the past 200 years or more, the consensus has been that that really refers to the legislative power, the power to legislate. And in every state, the legislature itself is a creature of a state constitution. There are limits on legislative authority that comes from state constitutions. Legislatures usually cannot act without the approval of a governor. And even more recently, the U.S. Supreme Court has indicated that legislatures, that the legislative power can rest with the people. And so sometimes in some states, there are ballot initiatives and referenda that are passed by the people. And the Supreme Court has accepted that that is part of the legislative power. And so this really would be a major shift from long established practice.
Right. You mentioned citizen bodies that are empowered to do this in some states. There was a Supreme Court case, I think, coming out of Arizona about 7 years ago, where there was one of these initiatives that took away the redistricting power from the legislature. Legislature challenged that, says, nope, you can't do that, independent legislature. The Supreme Court said, yeah, you can do that. So we've got this precedent in place, but we've got a different court now. How do you see that playing out?
So you're absolutely right about that. So that case was Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission versus Arizona Legislature, where the court rejected a version of the independent state legislature doctrine. Now, that was a 5-4 decision. And two of the justices in the majority there are no longer on the court. Actually, now three, that Justice Breyer has left. But that majority included Justice Anthony Kennedy. It included Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They've been replaced by justices who have a different view of the world in many cases. And so I think that, you know, a lot of those who follow these issues wonder if those justices will be very respectful of this precedent, even though it is quite recent.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Susan is with us in Milwaukee. Susan, hi.
Hi. I am very concerned that the Supreme Court, under its current makeup, is going to take this bill on, because we have a strong majority, basically, that have come out of the recommendations of the Federalist Society, which claims to be conservative, but is actually less conservative than it is supporting of major corporations. And although I think Roe versus Wade is a red herring put out, you know, to distract us all, if you look at the rulings of the conservative justices, they have been overwhelmingly in favor of corporations over the rights of citizens. And what this would do is give state legislatures rights that I think are highly disproportionate, very much fly in the face of the Constitution. The Constitution set up a system of government that very carefully employs checks and balances. By giving the votes in a state to the state legislature that is not answerable to the state constitution, this flies absolutely in the face of checks and balances.
Susan, I gotcha. Rob, what do you think? Would this be, in effect, at a state level, an unchecked, unbalanced power?
You know, that is one of the main concerns with this doctrine. It does mean that the legislature, again, depending on how strong a form of this theory would be adopted, you know, in its strong form, the power to set the rules for federal elections would be left to the state legislature alone. The legislatures in many states are legislatures that themselves have been gerrymandered into power. And normally we do think of those legislatures acting in a broader institutional environment where they can't pass a law without getting approval from a governor. They can't pass a law if it appears to contravene their own state constitution. And so those checks, those protections are stripped away under the independent state legislature theory.
Susan, thanks for that call. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court taking up a major election law case with UW-Madison law professor Rob Yablon. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much power should a state legislature have over the circumstances of federal elections in a state? Elections for president, for Congress, for the U.S. Senate. Do you want to see the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, give state lawmakers more of that power? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk now with UW-Madison Law Professor Rob Yablon. He's with us for a look at the independent state legislature theory and a U.S. Supreme Court case that could change election law in states around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this independent state legislature idea? Should the state legislature in a state be the only body that sets laws for elections for Congress and the presidency? Join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry it could make gerrymandering worse? 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Elise is with us in Ashland. Elise, hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear.
Oh, very good. Well, this is, I've got a question just for the professor, and I suppose it's kind of a big one, but it's you were talking about the admittedly uncertain prospect that if the court does go this way, that state legislatures would be able to appoint presidential electors directly. And, so on the one hand, I think we're all fairly familiar with the Electoral College now and how it distorts the vote. But I think, we're pretty used to being able to, if we can't vote for the president, at least we have the right to elect our state's electors. But of course, it wasn't always that way, back in the antebellum years, and I don't know if it continued after the war, quite a few states had the legislature choose the electors. And, that just, as a citizen, that sounds completely alien to what we think of in our democracy. As I was just asking the professor to speculate on just what does that mean for our...
I gotcha. Ideas? Elise, thanks a lot for the call. Rob, the idea that a state legislature could say, yeah, we won't do the popular vote thing anymore. We'll go to... the state lawmakers will vote and determine the electors themselves. Is that possibly something that could happen under this theory?
You know, it is conceivable. So the caller is right that in the early history of our country, we did have state legislatures that chose presidential electors themselves. That practice largely died out by the 1820s. And from that point on, the presidential electors have been chosen by voters. And if the independent state legislature theory were decisively rejected, I think it would be quite clear that the legislature would not have the power after the fact to try to choose its own electors when the voters, by law enacted by the state legislatures themselves usually, have chosen a particular presidential candidate. On the other hand, if the independent state legislature theory is endorsed, it at least does leave the door open to arguments that legislatures retain that power to step in after the fact if they don't like the results of the popular vote and choose their own slate of electors. You know, are there other potential limits on that? Yes, but it would at least mean that we would likely see more of those arguments and potentially more of those attempts.
Thanks for that call. We got an email from Matt in Madison who writes, putting the massively gerrymandered Wisconsin legislature in charge of elections is tantamount to putting the fox in charge of the hen house. Matt goes on, Republicans have proven over and over again that their goal is to win in any manner they can. They've attacked the very foundations of democracy and literally faced zero consequences. Can you talk about how, Rob, here in Wisconsin, this independent state legislature theory, if again ratified or confirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court, could play out here in the state?
Sure. Again, it could have a number of implications. In the districting context, it would mean that in the future, people would not have opportunities to make arguments to the state Supreme Court that the legislature overstepped, whether by engaging in partisan gerrymandering for congressional districts or by violating other state constitutional provisions when it drew its congressional lines. Beyond redistricting, it might mean that there would be more difficulties for election administration, because if it really is only the legislature's prerogative to set the rules for elections, then it wouldn't be clear to what extent we could rely on some of the other institutional actors that traditionally have played a very big role in administering elections. So sometimes what the law is underspecified, and we need the Elections Commission, we need local clerks to actually step in and make some of the decisions that help elections operate. And under the independent state legislature theory, it's not clear how much leeway those actors would have any longer to do their jobs. And then beyond that, there is the possibility, as we've talked about before, that a Republican-controlled legislature might feel emboldened to try to appoint its own slate of electors, even if that went against the popular vote.
Talking to Rob Yablon from UW-Madison's Law School, looking at a U.S. Supreme Court case the court has agreed to hear, saying that state legislatures should have more power, maybe exclusive power within a state, to set the terms of federal elections. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Ken is with us in Libertyville, Illinois. Ken, hi.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. A quick question. So in regard to a state legislature basically just picking its own slate of electors for the presidential election, regardless of the way the vote went, is there some requirement that the joint session of Congress or the vice president or the Electoral College itself, if it is an entity, to basically put conditions and say, we will not accept your electors unless they were chosen by method XYZ? And so it would be like kind of like a federal safeguard that would say, you know, if your electors were just picked because, then we're just not going to count their votes. And I know that could lead to a situation where you don't get to 270 electoral votes, but I'm not considering that as part of the question.
Ken, thanks for the call. Interesting question, Rob. If the Supreme Court says the Constitution says state law legislatures get to do this, can Congress say change laws along with the president to say, yeah, you can't do that?
You know, it's a great question to what extent Congress would have some reserved authority to do that. Now, there is already a longstanding federal statute called the Electoral Count Act. It's been on the books since the 19th century. That law came into play a little bit in the 2020 election, and it does set some rules for the circumstances when Congress is supposed to count electoral votes, when there are competing slates of electors, how those slates of electors are supposed to be processed. The law is notoriously unclear. There have been a lot of people advocating for efforts to update and clarify that law, but that is at least a possible check and safeguard, although, again, it would sort of be untested and we wouldn't know exactly how, say, the U.S. Supreme Court would respond in terms of the constitutionality of that kind of a law.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Guy next in Milwaukee. Guy, hello.
Hi. From what I understand, regardless of the Electoral College, if, let's say, a Republican legislator found out that a poll stayed open 3 minutes later than they were supposed to because their clocks weren't synced up properly, and it happened to be in a blue district or a red district, makes no difference, they could just say, we're going to eject that whole district's votes because they didn't follow the rules exactly to the letter. Is that the case?
Guy, thanks for the call. And Rob, I've heard that concern that a state legislature could set up stringent conditions that say, hey, if you violate these policies, X number of votes, or it's up one way or another, votes could be excluded, as some people might see, unfairly. Is that a concern?
You know, I do think that that would be a concern if, again, it is the legislature that has unilateral power to make these decisions. You know, right now, and for a long time, we've accepted that some of these decisions can be made by local clerks, that they can be made by the Elections Commission, and that courts may play a role. So, for example, you know, there are times in the past where you might have the power that's gone out at a particular polling place, and a court extends the hours of voting. Now, if the independent state legislature theory were enacted, it's not clear that that power would exist anymore. And if the polling place stayed open longer, it's not clear what the implications of that would be. So, you know, one of the concerns about the independent state legislature theory is precisely because it is novel and untested. There really is some potential for it to create uncertainty in our system and, you know, possibly undermine electoral integrity at a time when that's, you know, really not what we need.
Guy, thanks for that call. And Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Good talking to you.
Robert Yablon is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Law School. He was with us today to talk about a case taken up by the U.S. Supreme Court that could give state legislatures more power over federal elections in their states. Hey, a related issue, the Wisconsin Supreme Court expected to issue a ruling on drop boxes, ballot drop boxes in Wisconsin elections. We are planning to talk about that tomorrow here on Central Time. Meantime, watch WPR.org for news about that. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, some communities around the world and around the country have been experimenting with a universal basic income program, and there are pilot projects here in Wisconsin, too. Find out how they work, what kind of results they've seen so far, and join in with your thoughts and questions. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Here's a great opportunity for you. NASA wants you to volunteer as a storm chaser on Jupiter. Okay, it's not as exciting as it sounds, but it's also way less dangerous than it sounds. NASA announced a new citizen science project last week. They're looking for people to help go through these extensive online images of Jupiter's atmosphere that are pretty cool looking. And if you do this, you look for certain kinds of cloud activity and turbulence. So you can do this from the comfort of your own home, and the name of the project really sells it. You can be a Jovian vortex hunter. You can literally start right now. Just go to the NASA Citizen Science webpage, click the Jovian vortex hunter link, and start exploring. It's space news you can use. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, in America's post-Roe world, doctors and prospective patients are concerned that fertility treatments could become the next target. Find out more today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now think back, if you encountered a live animal today, a dog or cat, squirrel or bird, mosquito or bee, did you see it, hear it, smell it? Did you stop and think about how that creature might have been sensing you? Our next guest says, trying to imagine how other non-human animals experience the world we share can open us up to entirely new appreciations of our surroundings and the beauty and complexity of animals. He digs into the science of animal senses in a new book, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are the animals in your life that you see? Domestic, pets, barnyard, backyard, wild animals? Do you spend much time observing or trying to get to know them? What questions do you have about how animals experience and sense the world? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ed Young is a science writer at The Atlantic and author of I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us, and A Grander View of Life. His newest book is called An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. Ed, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me again.
One word appears a lot in your book. It's a German word, Umwelt, and it's this idea of how animals perceive the world. Can you talk a little bit about that concept?
Yeah, the Umwelt is the particular slice of the world that each animal can perceive. The unique sets of sights and sounds and textures and smells that it's privy to, but that other creatures might not be able to sense. So we humans, for example, our Umwelt includes a lot of colors that my dog, for example, cannot see. But we cannot sense the Earth's magnetic field in the same way that a songbird might be able to. We can't sense a lot of colors that songbird can see. We can't sense the electric fields that a shark or a duck-billed platypus might be able to sense. Each creature is limited in its own way. And even though our senses give us this powerful illusion that we have a complete and total perception of the world, that very much is an illusion. We are all trapped in this specific sensory bubble, and that is what the Umwelt is.
Before we get into some specific senses, one thing that struck me is there's a lot of science looking at the way animals sense the world, and we know a lot, but we don't know a lot. There's a lot of frontiers in this field of study.
There's so much we don't know. I mean, people have been puzzling over this for millennia. But even then, new senses keep on being discovered. You know, things like echolocation, how bats use sonar to navigate their way around, was only discovered in the 40s. Magnetoreception, how animals sense the Earth's magnetic field, was only really known since like the 60s and 70s. And even now, there's so much we don't know. I think there's more unknown than known. And partly that's because each creature has its own Umwelt. So every animal out there is, you know, this whole other world for us to learn about and to imagine.
Let's start with an animal that a lot of us do get to witness in action using the sense a lot. Dogs and their sense of smell. First of all, talk about the mechanics. What's going on when a dog is smelling something that works maybe a little differently than we do?
Yeah, so all of the stuff inside the dog's nose and brain that's devoted to smell, the cells that pick up odors in the air, the neurons that send information to the brain, the parts of the brain that analyze those smells, there's just more of all of that stuff. But there are also certain like anatomical specializations in the dog's nose that make it just amazing at smelling. For example, when I inhale, all of the air rushes past my nose, but most it all then goes into my lungs. When I exhale, I blow out a lot of the odors that are then trapped in my nose. The dog actually splits that airflow into two so that there's a part that's devoted entirely to smell and doesn't go to the lungs. And so all the odors that a dog inhales just sits there. They're not constantly pushed out in the way that ours are. The dog's nose also, next time you look at your dog's nose, note that there are slits that go to the sides. The nostrils curve around. That's really special. So when a dog exhales, you might think that its breath pushes away odors on the ground in front of it. But in fact, those side slits create these little whirling vortices of air that sweep those odors into the nose. So regardless of whether the dog is inhaling or exhaling, it's getting this continuous conveyor belt of scent coming into its head.
We're talking to Ed Young about his new book, An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. You can join in if you have a question about how animals sense the world at 800-642-1234. If you have a dog and you want to share its story of hunting for smells, 800-642-1234 is the number. Ed, people might look at the dog's nostrils and say, aha, dogs are better at smelling than we humans, or they're twice as good at smelling as some other animal. One big takeaway I got from your book is it's really hard to compare better or worse in our sensory world.
Totally. Yeah. So when you, you know, these numbers keep on cropping up, but what does it mean to be better at smelling, right? Do you smell a wider range of things? Can you detect them at smaller concentrations or from greater distances away? In some cases, humans actually perform just as well as dogs as discriminating between different odors, but dogs are just much better at using their noses. They're more experienced at it. They have that distinctive anatomy that I told you about that means that they're very good at sniffing continuously. And, you know, partly the difference is just very obvious to anyone who owns a dog. Like, we go outside. I walk around my neighborhood with my dog, Typo. He's a corgi. And, you know, the neighborhood seems the same to me. It doesn't seem to be changing all that often. But to him, every walk is an adventure because to his nose, things keep on changing all the time. Like, new other dogs have walked past and left scent behind. They've peed on things. They've left scent in their footsteps. He can get all of that. And so when we go on walks, you know, I start understanding that the world around me is actually changing in really dramatic ways that I can't perceive, but that he, with his nose, which he uses very well and knows how to use, really can perceive.
And a big bit of practical advice you give in the book is, if you have a dog, let it smell stuff. Could you talk about what that does for your dog?
Yeah, I think it's a shame that a lot of dog owners sort of yank dogs along on their walks. You know, they see the walk as a trip from A to B or purely about exercise. I think of the walk as a chance for the dog, for Typo to be a dog. And that means sniffing. Like, if I, at least on one walk a day, he decides the pace of the walk. Whatever he wants to sniff, with some small exceptions, he gets to sniff. And when we give him that agency, the walks take a long time. They're very slow. And I think that's good for him. You know, to deprive him of that is to deprive him of a huge part of his doghood. And there have been studies showing that dogs are happier, right, more optimistic, less anxious when they get a chance to really use their noses in the way that, in the way that they have evolved to.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jim is on the line. Jim, hi.
Hello. This is Jim.
And what do you want to ask about, Jim?
I want to ask I'm curious how dogs are able to discern, like, cancer or diabetes in a person. What is that sense involved? It seems such a minute change. What is going through their noses when they're able to figure that stuff out? Or how do they train them to even do that?
Jim, thanks for the call. It wasn't a healthcare thing, Ed, but you went to a fine scent training program for dogs.
Oh, I didn't, but one of the scientists I spoke
to
did. And yes, Jim is right. There have been a lot of studies showing that dogs can sniff out the scent of different diseases, everything from cancer to diabetes to even COVID. Now, whether that makes sense as a practical screening option in a medical setting, I'm a little dubious about, but it does show the amazing capacity of a dog's nose. And this really is just about smell. It's about the fact that disease changes the physiology of a person's body, and it changes the kinds of chemicals that we release from our skin. You know, all animals, all living things really are just leaking bags of chemicals. We all release scent, whether we like it or not, and things about our lives, our health, change the nature of that scent. Dogs can detect that, and the training them really just involves giving them a decent sample of healthy or sick individuals and letting them, letting their noses do their thing. It sort of reflects the kind of stuff that dogs do all the time. You know, we can train dogs to detect, like, explosives or drugs. You know, there are even dogs that scientists have trained to detect, like, the smell of whale poop so that they can find whales in the open ocean for their research. These all feel a little bit like parlor tricks to me, and they're incredible, but the dogs are doing this all the time. So when my dog goes on a walk and he's sniffing patches of pee that other dogs have left behind, I think that he can get stuff about their health, their, you know, maybe what they've eaten recently, or all kinds of information that I wouldn't be able to get. And, you know, to me, when he does that, it feels to me like me checking my social media feeds. You know, it's an update on what all the dogs in the neighborhood are up to and how well they're doing right now.
Thanks for the call, Jim. We're talking to Ed Yong about his new book, An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. Do you have a question about how particular animals perceive the world, see, smell, feel, magnetify, you name it? Is there an animal you've observed and wondered, what the heck are they doing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We've been talking about dogs and smell. We're going to get into some less familiar territory coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with science writer Ed Yong about his new book, An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. All right, Ed, let's check out a sense that we humans probably don't have, the ability to sense the Earth's magnetic field. A lot of species can do this, apparently.
Yeah, songbirds can do this. You know, a lot of the very simple birds that we see around us all the time have this ability. Sea turtles can do it. Some moths and very simple insects can do it. This ability it essentially gives them a built-in compass. It allows them to migrate over long distances and to keep their bearing without any other kind of landmark or any kind of hint. And, you know, their abilities are truly extraordinary. You know, you can take a baby turtle that just hatches on the beach in Florida. That turtle, if you left it to its own devices, would head into the ocean and do a decade-long lap of the Atlantic, heading towards Europe and then back again to the US. If you expose that baby turtle to the kind of magnetic field it would experience at different parts of that journey, it will then swim in the right direction for that part of the world, even if it has never been in the water before. And that's, to me, incredible. You know, it has this sort of built-in magnetic sense, not only compass, but kind of a map of the Earth's magnetic field that would allow it to move over these continental distances.
A big question, an unanswered question, is how? Like, what is it in an animal, a turtle, a songbird, whatever, that allows them, what's their magnet nose?
Yeah, right. It's a fantastic question, because we, for other senses, we know the answer, right? Like with vision, I see with my eyes. I can tell you at great detail exactly the molecular things that are going on in my eyes that allow me to see. I can't tell you that for magnetoreception. I can't even tell you where the compass is in these animals. This is a subject of huge debate. There are lots of theories, but there's no conclusive answer yet. And partly that's because the magnetic field of the Earth moves through our flesh. So the organ that detects it doesn't need to be on the surface like an eye or an ear. It could be anywhere. It could be in the turtle's butt. It could be distributed throughout the turtle's body. And so finding it is incredibly hard. And it's not helped by the fact that magnetism is very counterintuitive. You know, it's hard to explain how it works. It's hard to explain how an animal might be able to sense it. And the magnetic field is incredibly faint. So whatever they're doing, you know, it's something quite special, and something that defies like the way we think about the senses normally.
Let's go back to our callers now. Angela is with us in Baraboo. Angela, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
I have a goose that I raised from a baby. She imprinted on me. And she was always very sweet and kind. But one day when I took her out of her enclosure, I was wearing my husband's jacket, which I didn't normally wear whenever I interacted with her. And she beat me up so bad. She scratched me. She hit me with her head. She pecked me. As soon as I took the jacket off, she was her usual sweet self. So
what was the jacket, Angela?
Well, it was just a red flannel jacket. But it was something that I'd never worn before, and it was cold, so I just put it on, but she was unfamiliar with it.
Interesting.
So
Angela, thanks for the call. Ed, clearly, in this case, a goose sensed something and didn't like it, which opens the door. Like, how do animals then interpret and take action based on some of their sensory input.
Right, right. And, you know, I should clarify for all of our listeners that I probably cannot explain to you why the animal in your life does the weird thing that it does. There are so many possibilities here, right? And I think that's part of like the joy of thinking about this topic. So was it something to do with smell? We know that birds, contrary to popular perception, do have a decent sense of smell. You know, was it something to do with color? The jacket might look red to Angela, but does it look to a different, something different to a goose? Probably like something bad. I don't know. Right. Or like, is it maybe, is there something to do with sound, right? Is there something to do with the way the jacket is rustling? Like it's really hard to nail down any of these possible options. And probably, you know, Angela doesn't want to really test it out by wearing the jacket more and risking another encounter. But I do think that what this says, and probably a lot of listeners have experiences like this, is that animals do sense things in strange ways and in ways that are different to what we sense and that can make their behavior very difficult to predict.
Thanks a lot for that call, Angela. We're talking to Ed Yong about his new book, An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. I want to talk about one we rely on a lot, Ed, and it's vision. And so I might think, okay, I see stuff, animals see stuff, I get it. I get what they're doing. Our eyes are really unique, and different animals, their whole eye systems are radically different. Can you share some of your favorites?
Yeah. So, you know, here's a very simple example. Our eyes face forward. So for the humans who can see, our visual world is in front of us and we move into it. But like a bird's visual world, say Angela's goose, it surrounds it. You know, its eyes are on the side, so it can see to the sides and probably a little bit behind. So its visual world is all around and it moves through it. You know, a duck sitting on a pond can probably see the entirety of the sky without needing to turn its head. And I think that's really remarkable. There are animals where different kinds of vision get distributed between different kinds of eyes. So some jumping spiders have more than one pair of eyes. There's one central pair that does like sharp, acute color vision. But then there's another pair to the side which handles movement. And if you block those eyes, the rest of the spider cannot detect things moving in front of them. Again, very, very unusual, very different from what we do. Our eyes are actually very unusual in being very, very sharp. Like we have excellent eyesight. Well, I mean, I don't. I wear bit, like heavy contacts. But like in general, humans have very good eyesight, surpassed only by eagles and other birds of prey. And if you think about the eyesight that other animals have, you realize that much of the world looks very different to them than to us. Like to a lion, from most distances, a zebra looks like a donkey. Lions can't see zebra stripes. They just fade into gray. Even with vision, even with the sense that I think at least sighted people are most familiar with and rely on the most, the sense that dominates our culture, our language, it's really different in probably the majority of other creatures.
One point I want to get to, Ed, before we run out of time, I think this is maybe a key takeaway from your book, is that understanding animals' senses can help us humans be better neighbors to them and figure out the ways that our behavior, our buildings, whatever, can really interfere with creatures in surprising ways. What kind of lessons do you hope we can learn from this?
Yeah, so, you know, in small ways we've already talked about, I think people can, you know, be better owners of their pets if they really think about their pets' senses and cater their behavior to the animals. But there are bigger consequences too of this tendency to assume animals live in the same umwelt as us. We flood the world with light and sound that distracts animals, that confuses them, that drives them away from habitats they would otherwise do really well in. These the consequences of this sensory pollution can be huge. You know, it can reduce pollination of plants. It can have fatal consequences for turtles and birds by diverting them into buildings or beaches instead of their migration paths or the sea. We don't really think of sensory pollution as a problem. because we don't really think of light and noise as pollutants, but they very much are. And I think that we need to start preserving the dark and saving the quiet, much as we would want to save a rainforest or a coral reef. Doing so creates a world which is more hospitable to the animals around us, and I think makes us closer to nature. You know, in the early pandemic, when people stopped moving about so much and were much quieter, we heard a lot more birds around us. And that's because in quiet, we hear over longer distances and we hear more. We become more connected to the world around us. And I think that can only be a good thing.
Ed, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Ed Yong, science writer at The Atlantic. He joins today for a look at his new book, An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. A lot more senses and animals that he gets into in the book. And you could share your stories about animal perception or your curiosity about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at an expected state Supreme Court ruling on the use of ballot drop boxes for voting here in Wisconsin. You can join in with your reactions to that decision and whether you think drop boxes should play a role in voting here in the state. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. A Wisconsin recipe expert shares great summertime dishes, plus some advice on meal prep for maximum flavor with minimum effort. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.